You're listening to Side Hustle Pro, the podcast that teaches you to build and grow a side hustle from passion project to profitable business. And I'm your host, Nikayla Matthews. So let's get started. Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. This is episode 8 of Side Hustle Pro. Before we get into today's episode, I just want to give a huge shout out to everyone who has subscribed, downloaded, shared, and reviewed the show. We're closing in on almost 5,000 downloads, and that would not have been possible without your support. Speaking of support, though, let me be real with y'all for a second. I would so appreciate a review in the iTunes App Store. Reviews are what gets Side Hustle Pro onto iTunes radar, and that enables discovery by more people who need to hear these stories. We need to change the narrative of entrepreneurship. So please, please, please subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes. Now, without further ado, I'm delighted to introduce today's featured guest, Stephanie Lampkin. Stephanie is the founder of Blendor, a mobile job matching app that hides candidate name and photo to circumvent unconscious bias and facilitate diversity recruiting in tech companies. Studies have shown that two identical resumes with only a name difference can yield 100% difference in response rate. Blendor's goal is to highlight the information that's most relevant to a candidate being a good fit, independent of race, gender, military history, or sexual orientation. Stephanie, the founder and CEO, received her BS in engineering from Stanford and her MBA from MIT Sloan. Welcome to the show, Stephanie. So tell us a little bit more about who you are and what you're currently working on.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me. So yeah, as you mentioned, founder and CEO of Blendor. My journey to tech and to Silicon Valley is a little unique. I am the product of a single parent who at one point was homeless, and we ended up moving to DC because my auntie at the time was enrolled in computer science program at the University of Maryland College Park. So that actually ended up being pretty influential in my trajectory because the same auntie is the one that got me into coding at a very young age. So I was introduced through her, through this organization called Black Data Processing Associates, when I was 13, started these coding courses every Saturday for about 4 months during the summer. And I became a full stack developer by the time I was 15, took AP Computer Science in high school, and kind of took off from there between Stanford, a five-year career at Microsoft, and then most recently graduating from MIT with now Blendor being my second tech startup.
Oh, wow. Oh, your second step tech startup. Tell us about your first.
So my first startup was called Who and Where. It was a group travel planning tool that takes the pain out of organizing trips for multiple people, primarily around collecting money from everybody, getting everyone on board as far as where we're going, where we're staying, what we're doing, et cetera. I had traveled a lot. I've been to 27 countries on 5 continents, and oftentimes with family and friends and schoolmates. So this was my initial attempt at entrepreneurship was focused on travel tech.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that is such a pain. Do you still do that, or you kind of tabled
it? No, we kind of shelved it. So after I not really gaining a lot of traction, and then, you know, part of my story is kind of when that startup was heading south, I interviewed for an analytical lead position at Google. I was going to go back into corporate America, and I met with about 8 different people. I thought it went really well, but the recruiter came back and basically said they didn't think I was technical enough, but that they'd hang on to my resume in case a sales or marketing position opened up. So that was really my aha moment around why something like Blendor could be useful. And I started it at a hackathon in October of 2014, and everyone loved it and said, whatever you're doing now, you should drop it and focus on this because you're onto something.
Wow. Now, this is not going to turn into a Google bash session. Don't worry.
But they're one of my faithful customers now.
I feel like you just spoke my story right now, except a little different. So I don't know if you listened to the first episode, but I talk about how I interned during my, I went to Ross for my MBA, and during my first and second year interned at Google, thought it went really well. I got like one of those Google bonuses. I mean, it was just, I was just so sure that I was going to work for Google after after I graduated. And then, you know, they told me I wasn't analytical enough and I didn't get the offer. And I was like, scratches my head like, excuse me?
Yeah, it's crazy. So, but then they'll come back and say, oh, you know, the reason why our diversity numbers are so poor is because it's a pipeline problem.
Exactly.
There's just not enough educated, qualified women and people of color.
Right. Mind you, I have a whole list of really qualified people who I know personally who've been rejected now, including you.
Yeah.
I can add you to that list.
Yeah.
We'll move right along. We'll move right along. So we'll come back to your founding story. But, you know, I don't want to skip over the fact that you went to undergrad at Stanford, then you went to MIT Sloan for your MBA. So by all accounts, you were set to follow a traditional corporate path. When did you feel this entrepreneurship call?
Honestly, it's always been there. I come from a family of entrepreneurial women. My mother has kind of avoided corporate America as much and as often as possible. So I was always exposed to female entrepreneurs. You know, when I was in high school, I was setting up her QuickBooks and doing her inventory and receipts. And so that I always had that bug. And, you know, when I took the offer at Microsoft, I kind of opened myself up to the possibility of being, you know, a lifer with a company, with a really great company. But after about 2 years, I realized the glass ceiling was real. And really more so because of gender than anything else, because there were a lot of men of color who were inhibiting my progress at the company. So yeah, once I kind of got the real deal of corporate America, I realized that if I wanted to be able to demonstrate my full potential, I would have to do it on my own.
That is like such a key statement right there. There's only so much you can go. There's only so much you can do sometimes with that ceiling and someone else calling the shots and when someone else gets to determine your growth and progress in a company. So now let's go back to the idea for Blendor. How did that process come about? Did you side hustle before making the leap?
No, not for this venture. So for the previous one, I did start that idea while I was working at Microsoft. So I did do the moonlighting thing for a while. But for the second one, I kind of went all in from the jump. So while in business school, I didn't recruit. I didn't give my resume to the university. I was very determined to kind of focus on starting a company. And it's easy to transition into a startup out of business school because you're kind of used to not getting a check on the 1st and the 15th, right?
Okay.
So I knew that if I went back to corporate America after business school, I would get spoiled and I would, you know, create all sorts of expenses. But, you know, kind of avoiding that made things a lot easier.
Okay. And so then how did you financially prepare for this path? Because you're in business school. Did you avoid trips? I mean, business school is such a like wallet bleeder.
Yeah. So partly a little bit of savings, while I was at Microsoft, I maxed out my contribution to my 401k. And little known fact, you can dissolve your 401k while you're in school without having to pay the penalties, so long as you're in school. So that helped a lot. And then I did a crowdfunding campaign where I sent to everyone that I knew that, hey, you know, I'm graduating from Sloan. Instead of a graduation gift, help me with some early stage seed money so that I can start this company because it's something that I'm really passionate about doing. And I was able to raise probably about $15,000 to $20,000 just doing that alone.
Wow, that's really impressive. So what were some of the other first steps you took when you decided to take Blendor from idea to startup?
First steps. So the first step I did was build it. In my previous startup, I outsourced the development and got really dismal results. So for this one, I committed to at least building the first version of the product. So I locked myself away for 2 months and focused on kind of relearning the code and understanding how to create a mobile app. So I did that. And then the onus was on me to just pitch it, to show it to people. The timing was perfect. So in January of 2015 was when, Intel had made a $300 million commitment to diversity, and I somehow landed a meeting with the chief diversity officer, Rosalyn Hudnell, and she loved it. And so that got me, I literally packed up and drove from New York to San Francisco.
You did what?
Yep. I mean, I was getting such a positive response. It was so different than my previous startup where I felt like I was pushing the idea on people versus this one where everyone was more so pushing me to execute.
Okay.
So it was a very strong motivation, a very strong validation that this was something that was needed and important. So I pretty much sold the house and the farm, right? I moved to SF and found a lawyer who believed so much in what I was doing that we put together a fee deferral agreement, which was essential because she got me all set up as a Delaware C Corp. We got, you know, official business bank account, kind of all the fundamental stuff out of the way that I wouldn't have been able to do without her. So that was really valuable. And then I just started going on this pitching circuit, just pitching, getting exposure, meeting as many people as possible and getting more feedback so that I could optimize the product.
Okay. So let's take a step back and talk a little bit about this lawyer, because a lot of times entrepreneurs, when they're starting something, they don't know what step to take first. Do you think that the lawyer was essential to this? Like, so should everyone go out and try to find a lawyer to help them structure deals and structure the pitch process?
Not necessarily around structuring deals or structuring pitches, but just making sure that you have the fundamentals, right? So making sure that you are incorporated optimally, that you have kind of all your checks and balances in place so that when you are ready to raise money, even if it's from family and friends, that everything is covered, all your bases are covered. And it also helps as you bring on employees, because there's contracts and NDAs and all sorts of things that have to be in place, even if they're just 1099 contractors. It just legitimizes everything you do going forward. But in terms of structuring pitches and deals, it's not really about that. It's more so just about creating a solid foundation for good business future.
Got it. And how did you make the decision to set up a Delaware C Corp as opposed to another type of business infrastructure?
It's a pretty well-known thing. It's most tax friendly. It's easiest in terms of bringing on contractors, employees. It's a common practice for the most part. Yeah.
Right. We're just breaking it down for the folks who don't know what that is.
Yeah. And there's a ton of resources online that can give you comparisons of C Corp versus S Corp, sole proprietorship, LLC, et cetera.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
So you've gone through this pitch process. Walk us through that a little bit. And what's the, you know, as of today, total amount of money that you've raised?
So as of today, we have officially raised about $300,000.
Wow.
We just closed on a little bit more cash. But that's actually still below the minimum amount that we need to raise. So I'm still very much in the fundraising process. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, what was your second question?
Walk us through the pitch process.
It's different pitches for different audiences. I've won several pitch competitions. I probably won over $50,000 in pitch competition winnings alone. And that pitching on stage is more of a performance. It's more of a, how do you resonate with the audience given only 2 to 3 minutes? So that they understand what you're doing, the viability of it, and how and why it works. But when you're pitching to investors, it's a whole nother type of story because they're more so focused on what kind of traction have you had? What are the unit economics? Why is this going to work? What are you going to do with the money? What is your expected burn rate, financial projections? So it's much more focused on how can this bring me significant value and returns. There's definitely an art to crafting your pitch and tailoring it to the different audiences that you talk to.
And I'm so glad you broke down the different types of pitches because, you know, I think a lot of people, they might watch Shark Tank and they might think they're going to go in and say a cute little, poem and break down their business and then have people vying to bid and invest in them. And that's just not how it is. How do you decide who to pitch and what competitions to enter?
It's really just whatever is focused or tailored to what I'm doing, what I qualify for. I don't really limit where and what. It's just, do I qualify and if it's a good fit. So the pitch competitions I've done are usually around tech, or around diversity, or around people operations. So kind of those three categories.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what has been the most surprising part of this process of raising money?
The most surprising part about this for me is that even though venture capitalists claim to understand the importance of diversity, and even just in general in investment, people know diversity and portfolios are important, it's surprising to me how much they continuously invest in the same types of people with the same types of ideas. And oftentimes just follow. So it's a very sheepish kind of culture in that all it takes is to get one or two people on board and then everyone will follow. And so you see a lot of this, just the same pattern matching, a lot of homogeneity in just who's getting money. And, you know, there was the recent report released, Project Diane, uncovering that they're actually there's less than 15 Black women in the world that have ever raised $1 million or more in venture capital. And so, yeah, it's by far been the hardest experience I've ever gone through.
And how are you pushing through that? I mean, like, imposter syndrome, does that come up, and how do you fight it?
No, because I'm a little crazy, Michaela.
That's good.
For whatever reason, I have the opposite of imposter syndrome, and I have anti-bias because I know that there is bias towards white and Asian men. Oftentimes, I believe that they're less qualified, less smarter, less equipped because they've been given the benefit of the doubt versus I have not. I've had to work, you know, twice as hard for half as much.
Right.
So it's not even conscious, right? It's not even conscious. But when I do, you know, when I come across people of color and women out here that are still in the game, yeah, I hold them at a much higher, like I perceive them to be extremely higher in intelligence and grit and capabilities than I do the average white and Asian guy because they're just everywhere, right? So
I know. And it's kind of bad. And, you know, this might come as a shock to some, but I saw a phrase once and it said, carry yourself with the confidence of a mediocre white man. And and I always think of that when I start to get, you know, like insecure or feel nervous, because that just was my Google experience in a nutshell. It was really like, why am I doubted and why am I not given the benefit of the doubt of some of these men that I see walking around here not knowing ish?
It's good. Real.
I'm glad you have that attitude. So let's talk about the reception. You know, speaking of the bias, what has been the reception to Blendor from recruiting teams at tech companies?
Oh, it's been really positive. I mean, right now, a lot of companies are employing unconscious bias training, which many studies have shown are ineffective. And ultimately, a lot of these companies aren't seeing any improvement in their diversity numbers. Not sure if you saw Facebook's recent comments about their rationale for why things haven't gotten better. So overall, the response has been positive. People are looking for new and innovative ways to tackle this issue. And, you know, to be honest, many of them aren't really trying that hard, which is fine. I mean, all that does is create an opportunity for us to make a significant difference. And I feel confident in my ability to do that because I'm so connected to these communities that they aren't. And even just their perception about women and people of color, it's just so far off the mark. And it's sad on one hand, but it's great on the other hand, because it's an opportunity for me to demonstrate a lot of value.
Oh, great. And were there any surprises in what other companies or other sectors have been interested in Blendor's premise?
I'm getting requests from all across the board, from, you know, folks that are in government, actually the Pentagon. I had a meeting at the Pentagon. They're thinking about using Blendor internally for unbiased matching. I've had folks from finance, from retail, all across the board that have identified the need for this. So it's been very rewarding and validating to have that level of interest.
Oh, that's awesome. And you just reminded me of something when you said the Pentagon. I saw your video that you put up when you were invited to the White House to speak.
Yeah.
And President Obama shouted you out. You guys, I'm going to link to this in the show notes. And you the This Is Your Day song. Oh my God, I love that song.
Yes.
How do you stay focused when you start getting this type of attention? And it's easy to, like, you know, get caught up in the hype and lose sight of all the work that still needs to be done.
Oh, that's a good question. It's easy to stay focused when you're still cash poor, right? Okay. So yeah, all the media is great. Good looking out, Obama. But at the end of the day, I still haven't gotten major investment. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem. Like, I can't compete. I can't deliver excellence unless I have the support. So that's what keeps me focused and grounded at the end of the day.
Got it. And speaking of support, so as you expand, how do you go about selecting the right team? And have you faced challenges with this?
Yes, absolutely. Early stage company team building is a lot like dating. It's difficult to just go out on one date and kind of make a long-term commitment. And then sometimes you make a long-term commitment with someone and it doesn't work out, and it's really disappointing because you have to kind of go back to the drawing board. But I've been lucky, and honestly, the best folks that I've brought on have been people that are just passionate about this issue, and they've come to me just wanting to help, and compensation and incentives weren't even the priority. So I'm fearful of the time when I have to actively go out and look for people, because so far the inbound interest, the quality of the people that have come to me has been so extraordinary, and they've been so skilled and passionate. I've just been really lucky.
Oh, that's great. So you haven't had to fire anyone or anything crazy?
I've definitely had some poor contractor experiences, but no, not any full-time folks just yet.
Okay. And how do you approach onboarding? Do you have a full-out process, or you're just kind of like, we're still in the grind phase and just come on down?
I kind of start with just the drinking from the water hose type thing, where I just give, you know, I open the Dropbox and I say, okay, let's start with helping you understand what we're doing with the technology, helping you understand who our partners are, who our enterprise customers are, what is our 30, 60, 90 day plan. And then from that, we just hit the ground running. I mean, all a person has to do is shadow me for a week. And they'll get a really good sense about what we're doing and what the needs are and where we're going.
Cool. So what are the needs are? You know, where are you going? What other sectors do you plan to target to expand the app's reach?
Yeah, that's a good question. So right now we're just focused on fundraising and product development for the summer. But starting in the fall is when we'll start getting aggressive about bringing on more companies. Because as of right now, we've limited it to only big tech brands. Mm-hmm. So later in the fall, we'll be opening it up to other large multinational companies. And then from there, we'll start branching out into smaller companies and startups, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Also, my focus is on leveraging partnerships with, like, National Black MBA Association, Society of Hispanic Professional Engineers, Lesbians Who Tech, Veterans in Tech. Like, really, my go-to-market strategy is really to develop strong ties with those organizations that already have a great reach, so we can get as many candidates as possible on the platform.
Oh, great. And you just made me think of another question. You know, with this, with the pipeline excuse and all of that stuff going on, people are really getting frustrated. And there are a couple more businesses that are forming around this model of blind recruiting. So is there any thoughts of partnering, or, you know, how do you differentiate yourself as more of these pop up?
Well, no one that I know of has really executed well in terms of sourcing talent.
Okay.
Gap Jumpers is a company that gives a candidate an opportunity to fill out a quiz with no indication of identity. And then Interviewing.io masks your voice for the phone screening. But we're really tackling the issue in somewhat of a different way, just focus on the top of the funnel. Like, how do we just get people in the door in a scalable way? So for that reason, it's a lot different. And then we're also hoping, like, our broader strategy is around giving companies analytics about how far certain demographics of people are making in the pipeline. And then on top of that, giving companies an opportunity for branding. So what we've done is we've figured out how many women and people of color are in executive leadership for every company. What are their special employee resource groups? Do they have any special maternity leaves or programs or mentorships, et cetera, focused on retention? And from that, we've given every company on our platform a score. We call it the blend score. And so basically a score from 1 to 5. And what that does is it kind of creates sort of this like glass door effect where we're bringing more transparency to the consumer, to the end users, around what these companies are really doing to improve their numbers, as opposed to a lot of just the PR stuff that we've seen in the media. So hoping that increased transparency will put a little more fire in the engine to get companies to really invoke change.
I love that, because Glassdoor really does, you know, companies get that fire under their butt when those Glassdoor reviews are not good.
Yeah, exactly.
And is the idea also to, you know, have them keep this as part of their recruiting pipeline forever? You know, like, what's the model to sustain the app's use once the user finds the role they're looking for?
So on the candidate side, we want to expand into content, professional development content. So, you know, there's a lot of meetup groups and organizations and conferences and events and community things that happen around, you know, one's geographic area. So we want to expand to, okay, once you have a job, how can we match you with different entities to help in your career advancement, or to help you create communities within your space so that you don't get that, you know, like you said, that imposter syndrome burnout or that tokenism burnout? Because a lot of companies don't understand that, yeah, it's great that you're bringing in more minorities, but you have to create an inclusive environment for them to want to stay. And so we're hoping to kind of add a layer of that to the platform where we're helping women and minority professionals connect with others that are in their field, in their areas, so that they, you know, they can feel like they have a community.
I also love that, because especially within Silicon Valley, I know that the minority community is so tight because there's not that many of us.
Right.
And, you know, when we're going to jump, we're analyzing like, well, where else can I jump in this sector? So having that knowledge of, you know, what's going on with the companies, their Glassdoor ratings and all of that, and forming that community will be so helpful to when you do want to make a jump. And just to revisit the pitching and the financial aspects of this for a second. So how do you continue to financially sustain yourself given the unpredictable nature of entrepreneurship?
Yeah, so we stay really lean. Just try to keep expenses really low. I mean, obviously, we have a bit of cash in the bank, having raised $300,000 so far, but just keeping the burn rate really low. Like, okay. I share an office with a former classmate, so rent is half of what it usually is. And then I also have roommates so that I'm able to afford to live in San Francisco. And again, I think it's easier for me to maintain this sort of budget lifestyle because I am coming out of business school. I didn't go back to the lifestyle that I had before business school. And so for that reason, it's been a lot easier for me to stay pretty lean.
So you're not paying yourself a salary yet? It's
no, okay. No. Just covering basic living expenses for the most part.
Got it. All right. So now we're going to shift to the lightning round of the show. And that's basically where I'm going to ask you questions. You're going to answer the first thing that comes to mind. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Number one, what's a resource that has helped you in your business that you can share with the Side Hustle Pro audience?
LinkedIn by far is the most underutilized resource for most business people and entrepreneurs. I use it for all of my contacts and understanding who lives where and what they do, et cetera. This is a really great export feature Export to Excel that a lot of people don't know about. But yeah, LinkedIn has been my biggest resource for sure.
Yes, I'm so glad you mentioned that because you're totally right about that. I exported my contacts the other day and just sent one email blast. I was like, you guys, mm-hmm. don't worry, I'm not going to spam you every week, but just to announce the podcast. And yeah, LinkedIn definitely keeps that on the hush.
yeah.
Number two, what's been the best business book or podcast episode that you've consumed this year?
I'm somewhat of an economics geek, so I love Planet Money. Oh. There's some really, really great podcasts on that, and then Freakonomics similarly. And then probably the third one would be Recode Decode with Kara Swisher. Mm. She's interviewed quite a diverse group of folks throughout the year, so I always enjoy.
Yeah, I like her a lot. Does. She holds no punches.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, she's a little firecracker.
Oh yeah,
I love women under 5'2 in general.
Oh, I just missed the cut.
Sorry.
So number three, who inspires you and why?
Who inspires me? Probably my auntie. She was the one that we moved in with. So she's always been like my second mom. And she's the only one in my family that has always just had a like go get it sort of attitude, and she's always been the one that believed in me, and I feel like really recognized that I was different in a good way. So I'm always inspired to be successful, so one day I can buy her a big house and she'll live happily ever after.
And another question, which actually was crowdsourced, how does one break into tech with a completely different non-technical background?
Good question. I would say networking, right? So go on Meetup, find different Meetup groups, talk to people, because whether you come from a design, finance, HR, legal, like there's always dots that can connect you. So start there, and then just start dabbling in a little bit of code. Code Academy has some free courses that you can take, as well as lynda.com. Just to get you the foundation experience of tech, and take it from there.
All right. And finally, what's your parting advice for fellow women entrepreneurs who dream of working for themselves but don't know where to start?
Don't know where to start. Probably the biggest advice that I give women is really around what we touched on a little bit around overcoming imposter syndrome. I think we have something. I don't know if it's by birth, but women in general innately have overwhelming self-doubt, and it inhibits us from executing. And oftentimes we're perfectionists. So I'd say, if you have an idea, start with just designing something, throw something together, even if it's just a PowerPoint deck. Draw it out and start talking with people. The other thing is don't feel like you have to be secretive about your idea. No one's going to steal your grand idea and become a billionaire.
Please say that again. Because people really do not understand like the effort it's going to take someone to truly execute on your idea. Like,
And everyone executes differently. Right. It's somewhat of a lottery ticket who gets, who wins. But there were plenty of Instagram like apps before Instagram got a $1 billion buyout from Facebook. Right. So it's more valuable for you to talk to as many people as possible who can tell you, no, that's dumb, or yes, this is good, or maybe you should think about this feature, or maybe you should think about that. That's more valuable than hanging on to it for dear life. As we've seen with, unfortunately, Elizabeth Holmes of Theranos, right? She's super, super secretive.
Yeah.
And now her $9 billion just went to zero.
Right.
I mean, they're about to make a movie about her.
Yeah. Listen, women, talk to each other. Talk to me. Talk to us. Like, we are here to help and also learn from each other. So stop trying to make people sign your NDA just to talk about your idea.
Do not.
Because no one's doing that. NDA.
It's not how it works.
It's not how it works. All right, Stephanie. Well, it was so great having you on the show. I almost feel like I just want to keep talking to you, but I want to be respectful of your time. So what's the best way to connect with you after this episode?
Yeah, so you could shoot me an email at hello@blendor.com. I try to check that account once a week or so. Alternatively, follow us on Twitter @blendor. And yeah, my if you go to www.blendor.com, you can sign up for the app and get access to our beta.
Awesome. And there you have it. Hey guys, thanks for listening to Side Hustle Pro. If you want to hear more from me, head on over to sidehustlepro.co/sidehustlecorner to get my weekly Side Hustle Diaries chronicles about my own journey from passion project to profitable business. And if you want to find me online, I'm at Side Hustle Pro on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Don't forget to join the Side Hustle Pro Facebook community. Go to sidehustlepro.co/mastermind. And as always, if you love the show, do me a favor and subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes. Thanks, guys. Talk to you next week.